Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 80.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
At Ritual, Mother's Day is kind of a big deal, and we're celebrating accordingly. Find your ritual. If mom needs a bit of stress relief, digestive support, or is looking to support glowy, smooth skin, do it today with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast for 40% off your first month. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Kyle, do you need these headphones on or can I take them off?
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks for making your way here, for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button while you're hanging around. I'll give you new interviews just like this one every single week. You can grab a Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcasts from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Please do give the series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. We've had some great guests here lately. David Byrne and Jerry Harrison of Talking Heads, Don Felder of the Eagles, Ian Pace of Deep Purple, Jean Fogelberg, the widow of Dan Fogelberg, Lizzie Green, you can see her acting in Ransom Canyon on Netflix, Daryl Hall, John Oates, Bon Iver's Justin Vernon, Sarah McLachlan, Tracy Thorne from Everything But the Girl, Jeff Bridges, the dude himself. Just an example of what you get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. That's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, Adam Duritz. If there's a Mount Rushmore for 90s frontmen with gravity-defying hair and a knack for turning every breakup into a piano ballad, Adam Duritz is etched front and center. As the unmistakable voice of Counting Crows, he helped make Mr. Jones a generational anthem, turned August and Everything After into a dorm room staple, and gave Melancholy a radio-friendly makeover. Known for lyrical rambling that somehow always finds its way back to the chorus, he is one of my favorite songwriters of all time. And he is back with the band for the album Butter Miracle, the complete suites. In fact, the last time we talked, it was Butter Miracle, Suite 1. And I said, what does this mean? He goes, well, I guess it means I at least have to write another suites. And now, 4 years later, he has finally fulfilled that mission right there. So we get to talk about this this Butter Miracle album. We get to talk about rewriting half the songs from scratch and confronting the weird pressure of accidentally writing a perfect five-song rock record. We also get to dig into some of their most mythical songs, the ones that got away, Marjorie is Dreaming Up Horses, Shallow Days, Einstein on the Beach for an Eggman, Baby You're a Big Star, Good Luck. We get to hear about finding the personal connection in characters like Bobby, Elizabeth, and Maria, and how one of the songs on this new album started with a glam Zeppelin riff screamed around his house mid-lockdown. He also shares why they never got around to putting out something like a B-sides compilation. Spoiler, tape machines and poor planning is a part of that. And we'll talk about some of our favorite songs that they play live, some of their favorite songs that they play live, why This Desert Life might be the secret favorites in the catalog, or maybe not so secret. All that and more, I tell you, there are interviews that someone like me, as fans like you, dream about doing. This is that interview. This is the interview. And Adam and I have got to talk several times in the past. This is an interview, a dream that I've been hoping for ever since I found August and Everything After, along with all of you way back. So let's jump into it. We're talking Butter Miracle. It's Kyle Meredith with Adam Duritz of the Counting Crows.
Hey, man.
It's good to see you again. Last time we talked with Suite One and everything that was going on. took a few years. You said it might, but here we are. I do want to compliment you at the first here because you like artists that stick around decades. You don't always have the same expectations. These songs make me feel the same way your music did 25, 30 years ago. Like, blows my mind in a way, and I really do mean that.
Thank you. I'm really glad to hear that.
So how does this part of the story go? Okay, so we had the Sweets and those songs, you know, that existed. Are these all fresh songs? Did you write these afterwards? Like, where did these songs come from?
Oh, yeah, they're all written afterwards. You know, I wrote all those songs for Sweet One on my friend's farm. I was spending a lot of time in the west of England on his farm, and I wrote those songs there. And then I went back after these tours for Sweet One, and I wrote all these songs. And the thing was, on the way home, I stopped in London. I have some really good friends in this band, Gang of Youth. I had sung on the new record, but they decided to kind of remake the new record and toss it out. And they wanted me to go sing on it again, and I did. And a little while after they got home, they sent me the finished record, and it's really good. It's called Angel in Real Time, and it is really, really, really good. And it also made me realize these songs that I had finished weren't good enough. They were, some of it was there, and I've never had that happen before. Like, when I'm finished, I'm done. I know they're great, and they weren't. I mean, they were good, but not great and not up to that level, certainly. They were okay songs, you know. Some of them were fine. I mean, like Virginia Through the Rain was fine. It was great. I loved that. It was perfect. But I ended up like reworking Spaceman in Tulsa. It had too many parts, and I honed it down to what it is now. The song that is now Under the Aurora was a completely different chorus back then. I kept the verses, but kind of rearranged them and wrote a completely new chorus for it. I wrote the song with Love from A to Z, which hadn't existed before, which to me is kind of the defining song for the record. And then Boxcars had been this piece of music that I had, but a lot of the things on this record were stretching for me musically. Like, I had the concepts for them, but they weren't stuff I could really play on the piano. And especially Boxcars, which was always meant to be a guitar song and was absolutely impossible to play for me. So I could only kind of keep it in my head. I had the idea, but I couldn't even play it to write it. I had just some of the parts. I could play the chorus, and I had that, the first half of each chorus. But I really struggled with it, you know, and I reworked everything except for Boxcars, which I still couldn't really play. But I did all this work on the other songs, and I thought they were much better, and I was very happy with them. But it kind of, having to rewrite like that kind of shattered my confidence in them in some ways. And like, I sat with them for 2 years, like at that level. Once I had rewritten them, I sat with them for 2 years because I was really self-conscious about them and not comfortable sending them to the band and saying, hey, we're ready to make a record. I kept looking at them and feeling like there was something wrong just not knowing, which was a really weird experience for me. I've never had it before, but it's also the first time I ever thought I was done and then went back and like reworked everything. But I was right about reworking it. They weren't good enough, you know, and hearing Angel in Real Time really gave me some perspective on like, oh yeah, no, this is the level I usually work at, and I'm not there right now, you know? And I literally sat with it for 2 years being too like insecure and self-conscious about them to send them to the band. And finally, I guess in the spring of last year, it was before summer. Yeah, it was like early last year. I finally like called the guys and said, I called Millard, our bass player, Jim, our drummer, and Immer, our other guitar player, and said, I need you guys to come here and stay with me for like a week or two, or a week, maybe just a week. And I've got to demo out these songs. I never demo songs. Like, I never do. The only thing I do is I record them on my phone and send them to the band. And then we go in the studio. I go, I just can't tell if these are any good. I feel like they're great. I have no idea. One of them I can't play at all, so I can't finish it. I don't know what the fuck to do. But I need you guys to come here. And we need to somehow demo these. Immer called his friend Joey Wunsch, who's like a engineer at Flux Studios right around the corner. And Joey came and sat with us in my house. I cooked for everybody for a week. And we just like went through these songs. And one by one, we were like, oh, this is fucking great. Oh my God, this sounds great. This song's killer. Okay, great. You know, like once I had some guitars and a drum to drive them, because they were always meant to be kind of a lot more driving than some of the other stuff. And closer in some ways to Recovering Satellites that way, where I really wanted them to be about rock guitars, you know, and you know, every song kept one by one, they just kept coming out like, oh fuck, this is great. We were so excited and thrilled here at my house. And even Boxcars, which I finally got a recording of it that I could actually then finish writing it over, because it's the first time I'd ever had something that felt the way the song felt in my head, you know? And then we were all so fucking excited. We're like, well, let's get in the studio right away. And we went in like, I don't know, 3 weeks later, we went into the studio and did all this stuff. Like it was only like 3 or 4 weeks later, we went right in the studio. We had Joey called Brian Deck. He came in from Chicago. Joey actually engineered the studio stuff too, just like he had at my house. And we got Charlie to come in, and we just five of us to keep it like tight. And we just did it all. And then we went out like a month later, like in April or maybe early May. And we got the other two guitar players on the record. It was really quick. Like once, but it had been sitting. I know this record seems like it took fucking forever, but the reason is that I just literally sat on all this stuff for 2 years, just like wouldn't get off the pot on whether like I've never had to rewrite before.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Adam Duritz.
See, that's what's incredible, because when I listen to it, and I'm having a lot of the thoughts that you're confirming, by the way, about those driving guitars, even about Satellites and all that stuff. But the very first time that I listened to it, just the new five songs, I thought, these five songs are perfect. Did he only write five songs and they're perfect? Or did he write 15 songs and these are the five perfect songs? Like, the fact that these are the five songs, even with the rewriting and everything, like, yeah, you got it there. You know, no doubt about that.
I mean, I've never written a lot of extra tunes. I don't write very much. It's funny because when I started out songwriting, like I wrote in freshman fall term, my freshman year in college, I wrote my first song. And then for 4 or 5 years, all I did every day was write. I just played piano and wrote songs for like every day for years. But as soon as I got in this band, you know, I can't write on the road because I don't play guitar. I play piano very shitty. So I can't really carry it around with me into every hotel room.
Since so many of your songs reference cities, that's actually funny that they're not written on the road, you know?
No, there are very few of them have been because it's really hard for me to. I have to like bring a piano, like a keyboard from the gig and put it in the bus and then take it to the hotel. It's a huge hassle. Also, I don't have much extra voice on tour, and we tour so much that I don't write for like a year and a half. I won't write anything because I'm spending all that time on the road. And then I need some time off when I get home. And then I write a bunch of songs, we make a record. But it's never been a bunch of extra songs because I'm not writing all. I mean, I don't know why the reason is, but I tend to write very sporadically and then just do it all right then. Or I'll write while we're recording records. I've done that with a lot of records. I've written half the songs for certainly This Desert Life and Hard Candy. A lot of them, half of it was written in the studio. You know, so I've always been kind of sporadic about it. There have been extra tracks on records, but never a ton. Like I've never been like Springsteen where he writes a million songs, you know, like it's always been like maybe one or two extras if there were, and they're more left off because they just didn't fit in the flow of the record. You know, there've been songs like that.
Those occasional B-sides that are out there with, like Baby I'm Big Star Now or Eggman or whatever. Yeah.
Well, Einstein on the Beach, I didn't think was good enough for the record. I mean, it's a really catchy song. I just thought it was more clever than it was meaningful. So we didn't even record that for August. It was just a demo that Geffen put out later. You know, Chelsea is one of the songs from Satellites. Baby I'm a Big Star Now, that was more stupid than anything else. It was written while we were doing This Desert Life. John Dahl came to me and asked me to write a song for Rounders, the director. And I saw the movie and wrote the song and we loved it. But then I had already given Colorblind. During the making of that record, I also wrote Colorblind and gave that to Cruel Intentions. And so there was already this movie that had one of our songs in it from our record. And I was like, man, if every song on this record is already out on a soundtrack to a movie, why buy the record? And I'm like, so I told Rounders, you could have the song for the movie, but you can't put it on a soundtrack record. So they never put out a soundtrack album. I mean, just the one with the score on it, I think, as a result. And then when we were sequencing this Desert Life, it just was impossible to find a place to put Baby I'm a Big Star Now. It just didn't fit in the flow of the record. And I'm really strict about that. Like, I know nobody listens to records from top to bottom, but you have to be able to put our record on and listen from top to bottom, or I'm not going to do it, you know? And so I took it off the record, and now the fucking thing exists nowhere, which is my own fault completely. Cause it could just be on the soundtrack to Rounders if I wasn't an idiot, but you know, so there's been a few of those like that.
A song like that. And this will actually bring us back around to the album and how I want to talk about it. But you know, the way us fans treat a lot of these songs, especially as you reference certain lyrics, and we've talked about this before, how, you know, we'll follow, sometimes it's just lyrics and sometimes maybe it's characters. And for me, like Baby I'm a Big Star Now, sort of having a reference to Mr. Jones and we all want to be big stars. And now when I hear Spaceman in Tulsa, and to me, I'm like, this could be the natural trilogy of those three songs, while also referencing American Girls if we wanted to in that character. Like, does that ever float around in your brain that you see these characters popping, the same characters in these songs like that?
I mean, there are certainly characters that have popped up like that. I mean, the Bobby character flows through a lot of Sweet One and Sweet Tooth. You know, like he's in both of those sections. Because I think he represents me in a lot of ways, both as a person in like Elevator Boots and in Spaceman in Tulsa, who is a rock star and has spent his life making music, and in Bobby and the Rat Kings from the perspective of a fan who is in love with music, which is also me, you know, growing up completely lost in the romance of rock and roll as a kid, you know, and still, you know, to this day. So that, you know, and you know, there's Maria's in more than one song. And I think so is Elizabeth. No, Elizabeth definitely is. Because she pops up in, it's on This Desert Life too.
Yeah, Elizabeth. I get the melody in my head. Wish I Was a Girl, right?
Wish I Was a Girl. Yeah,
yeah, that's
it. One of my favorite songs.
Yeah,
no, and just in that there are references to ways I felt about things and things I thought about, and you know, these are all stories from one person, so it makes sense that characters pop up occasionally. You know, I mean, Spaceman is, you know, I never really thought about it that way. It is about things that Mr. Jones is about, in the sense that Mr. Jones is very much about dreaming of being a rock star. It's also about the realization of that dream will not be everything you want it to be, and that there's a lot of hollowness in it, but it's still an awesome dream, you know, like, because you want to be a rock star, you know, like, and Spaceman is also about the sort of redemptive quality of being an artist, you know, rock and roll in this case. As much as it's also about like the difficult lives a lot of people lead who end up becoming artists, you know, and how the crucible they have to go through to get there because of how, you know, horrifying or just lonely their lives have been. You know what I mean? Like growing up gay in parts of our country, which could be very difficult. Growing up as a girl in the way men treat girls. Yeah, I mean, it deals with some of those issues more explicitly than Mr. Jones does. And because that's an issue on a lot of songs on this record, is just peoples who are ostracized and isolated in our society, especially as our society is going these days right now, like the sort of difficulty of being different from everybody else. You know, that the great dream of America is that we make these decisions as a group, and that it's not a king or something. So majority gets to do things, but minorities are protected. That the Bill of Rights gives us protections from ourselves. But it's still always in the world going to be easy to find small groups of people to victimize and blame and restrict. And, you know, that could be Black people, Jews, Muslims, gay people, trans people. There's a lot of people you can pick on because there aren't as many of them as everybody else. You know what I mean? And that's that kind of socially is an issue on this record. And it was on Sweet One as well. You can see like Angel 14th Street. It's definitely about how some people think of women.
So when you're putting them together, when you, and this comes back around to what I was, I guess, getting at earlier, is like writing these two parts separately. I mean, I guess I'm making the assumption when I say this, it's obviously not a narrative from the beginning to end, but as you're saying, even with years apart, the themes are still intact.
Yeah, well, I think it's natural though because the same person wrote them, you know, and so things that are really sticking in my head right now, concerns about friends of mine, people who I identify with, you know, like I'm a crazy person who struggled with that his whole life and found, I always wondered how I was even going to feed myself or take care of myself or, you know, like. What place in the world was there for someone who was as handicapped and restricted as I was? You know, and then, you know, he turns out, oh, I get it. I'm a rock star. That actually worked out. It turns out there is enough room in rock and roll for me, you know, and I don't know. It's an, there are a lot of different kinds of small groups in the world, and, you know, a lot of different ways to be isolated and ostracized in society. And I don't know, it's something that's been on my mind recently, so it makes sense it pops up. And 2 years isn't really that much time to change that sort of mindset. You know, like I don't ever think or plan about themes when I'm making a record. It's never, I have tried and it's terrible. You know, I could never be Bob Marley. I just every time I've tried to write a song like that, they're just incredibly shitty and like not even worth finishing. But they're there. You know, I look back and I go, oh yeah, look, you know, that's a it's a picture of me over a period of a few years, usually, you know, a record, because we don't make them. Even in the early days, they were every 3 years. So yeah, I mean this was, I mean the suite, we were finishing the basic recording of Suite One as the pandemic hit. I mean, we were in the studio watching CNN, and Trump was at the CDC saying, I don't want people getting off those boats and giving me more cases. I've got six cases. I don't want more than six. You know what I mean? Like that's right where it was. So the city, we finished, and the shut New York was shut down like a day and a half after we finished. You know, so that, you know, we ended up, the other guys sent their parts from home. Mixing it was, everybody drove into New York and stayed at my house. I cooked for everybody, and we found a studio a block away so we could mix the record even. You know, so that even though there are a few years between those records, two of them were spent in isolation in the pandemic, you know, so didn't even have a chance to get many new ideas during that time because you didn't see any people.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Adam Duritz.
I mean, honestly, seriously, Catapult is one of the greatest lead-off tracks of any album for me. So with Love From A to Z, to me, is the greatest opening track you've had since Catapult. That's not even slighting the other albums, by the way. That's just that standard. And then when we talk about Spaceman, you get to Boxcars, and like, you guys rock from time to time, every album, but I don't feel like you've rocked maybe this hard since, I want to say, 1492,
Yeah,
maybe.
I think 1492 is the real precursor to Boxcars in a lot of ways. You know, and Boxcars is especially, it's so significant to me because it's an idea I had initially during the pandemic, because it began with a ridiculous guitar riff that I was writing that went na 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 na, but the lyrics to it were coronavirus, coronavirus, conk, conk, coronavirus. Co it was just like, and you know, while you're locked up going insane for 2 years in your house, I was walking around my house going coronavirus, coronavirus, conk, conk. You know, never thinking it was going to be used for anything. You know, because it, but I actually loved it as a guitar riff. It was very like Zeppelin-y to me. It's like a fucking great riff, and
Little glam rock on top of it.
yeah, I
Yeah,
mean.
right.
And then I wrote this chorus. The first half of it was that, you know, mom and dad and a couple of kids staring at the screen. I had this like really chorus about like blasé nuclear families hypnotized in front of their television screens while the world is falling apart, you know. And those are two completely separate things. But as I was trying to ex write that song that was went with that mom and dad chorus, it, one day I just sort of felt like, oh, holy shit. No, that fucking works. Oh my God. Can I, then I was like, can I make the chorus coronavirus? And then I was like, nah, mom and dad thinks the chorus. I can't do it. We'll have to get rid of that part. But the riff is killer. And, you know, while I was working on that at one point, I called Immer and like, do me a favor, walk over to my place. Cause he lives about, when he's in New York, he lives like 5 blocks away, 6 blocks away. And he came over. I'm like, I got to get a version. I just wrote this music. I can't play it at all. So I need you to do it. Just kind of like, but here's the riff. Here's how the verse goes. I don't have any words to it. And then this chorus is like this. I only have half the chorus. So I've got the first half of it. What is it? Mom and dad through, I can't remember. Makes it easier on you, makes it easier on me. That's all I had. The part that repeats every chorus. And I'm like, I just need to sing these parts and then I'll try and fill in the rest of it around it. And when he played the chorus, even though we were just using an acoustic guitar, it was so fucking cool with the and then going into the verse. I was so excited, but I still could never play it. And it was really hard to do it over that acoustic version. So I needed them to come here. Like, that's the last song I finished because I couldn't really even finish writing it until I had that demoed version from the band. But it had been in there beginning in the pandemic from that fucking stupid riff, you know, that just was like so ridiculous. But then like, it was just this wonderful metal, silly metalness that I was running around the house. My wall goes always like, will you fucking shut up? Like, cause you can't play music for 2 years. So all you've got is your air guitar and you're fucking, you know, like I can play piano, but fuck, I want to play rock and roll. And all I've got is just like this. The fact that it worked out and turned out into this, like, it's the apex of that, you know, like the first three songs, they're all pretty, pretty blistering from the way that Immer's guitar starts off from what, I mean, A to Z should be kind of a folk song, but instead it starts off with this really blistering kind of electric guitar. And then up to Spaceman. And then finally, like, climaxing with fucking coronavirus of all things, you know?
It's the one I've gone back to, like after I needed to stop listening to it all at once and I just want to punch in, you know, like Boxcars isn't when I go. And it's those moments. And I know we keep referencing Satellites here, but like Angels of the Silence and the way you all would play that live, you know, and that's how that song's making me feel. Like anytime I put on Live Across a Wire, that's one of the songs I go to, you know, it's because the feeling, it's that feeling, it's that drive, it's those guitars. And all of that's in there. Like, it's so much fun to hear
it's
that.
It's not something I'm usually great at writing, but I'm really proud of the few that have turned out. Like Angels, like Catapult, like 1492. There's a few on Cowboys on Saturday Nights. You know, I love those songs. And I'm always really proud when they work out because they're always really hard for me because I can't play them well to write them. It's hard to write them without the band. And so when they turn out, I'm like, but especially this one, just because the life it went through before it turned out was so like
almost comical from the sound of it. Yeah, that's yeah. I did want to ask, you know, we've already brought up something like Einstein on the Beach and all that stuff and the end of the album. So now that, you know, Sweet One finishes the album and you've got Bobby and the Rat Kings and somebody had, I don't think, you know, when we're talking about referencing lyrics, somebody pointed out like, oh, the end of Bobby, it's kind of the end of Einstein, of Eggman, you know, in the same way. We'll never be the same again, never be together again. We're stretching a little bit, just a little bit, but it's there. And it's one of those things, like, as you said, you didn't think that song was even good enough, but it became a top 10 alternative hits in its day and ended up on the greatest hits. You haven't played it for almost 30 years. And I know songs get left in the back, but what is it about that one? Why did that one never come back around?
I think we only played it once, really, ever. And it was a disaster. We completely fucked it up at that gig. It was right before the release of the first record, or right before we recorded it, one of the two. I had just written it. And I always felt the song was more clever than it was meaningful. Like, it's a clever idea, you know, intellectually, the idea that, you know, Einstein and that mathematics is this beautiful thing, but you could put a lot of thought into something and then kill so many people with it, you know, like, which is not the intention, but it's what happens, you know. And I do think that's a very clever idea. But it just didn't mean a lot to me. It's very like, look what I thought of, you know. When we were making the first record, I really wanted things you could really feel. Like, I mean, it just doesn't compare to Perfect Blue Buildings or Around Here or even Mr. Jones. You know, like it's just not the same kind of thing.
Which I would agree, but it's also a fun song.
It is.
In the way Accidentally in Love to me is a fun song, you know.
Also not on a record though.
Right.
Of course. You know, like, I mean, I love Accidentally in Love. And I do think that is a good comparison. And I don't play that very often either. I love the song and I'm very proud of it, but it's not as satisfying to express. It's just kind of like, it's exhausting and it's not, I don't get off during it. I get off during Mr. Jones, you know, but I don't really get off during Accidentally in Love, and I love it, but I love it almost from a distance. It also is clever. More meaningful than Einstein to me, in that it's very much about, you know, love is hard to plan out. And sometimes it's something you fall into and something you just miss out on. It can be sad. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in that song that I think is very meaningful to me and perfect for Shrek. And I really wanted to write a song for a cartoon because the really good ones, unlike anything else in our society and our culture, the really good movies for kids like that, animated stuff, it's timeless. It's one of the only things in our culture that crosses generations. My grandmother saw Snow White. My mom saw Snow White. I saw Snow White. I don't have kids, but my sister's kids saw Snow White. You know what I mean? It's like that shit never gets old. So you put a song in one, you know, it's timeless. And I wanted
forever, really, right?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of respect for the work, you know, that goes on in animation that way. It's hard to make things that last. But yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing. You know, I think if it hadn't all turned out the way it did, we probably would have ended up going back to Einstein more. Because I'm not as, part of the problem was that when our first record came out and finally blew up, you know, the Mr. Jones blew up. But the real thing that blew the album up was Around Here. We played it on Saturday Night Live, and Letterman and the album went through the stratosphere. Because even when we played Saturday Night Live and Mr. Jones was a hit, the record wasn't even in the top 200. You know, it wasn't any kind of a hit. Around Here was the motor for us becoming huge. But after that second single, the record was so big. We were selling 40,000 records a week. You know what I mean? It was so big. And I was really wary of backlash, which happened anyways. And just like, having your first record be that big is not necessarily always the best thing. And it's the end of careers for a lot of people. You know, you don't see much about Alanis anymore. You know what I mean? Like, you don't see much about Hootie and the Blowfish. You know, like that stuff, Spin Doctors. That really big first album thing is, even Nirvana, it was their second album. And they're so good that it's different. You know, they're just... So it was a real worry for me. And the record label came to me after Around Here and they're like, oh yeah, the next single, we should definitely put out Ring King. And I was like, no, no, no. That was always the plan though. We thought Mr. Jones was a good introductory track. Around Here was totally unique piece of like almost Springsteenian like drama or U2. And Ring King was the hit though. We all knew Ring King was the hit. That's the big hit on the record. And I was like, no, 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 no. I'm done. I'm not putting out any more singles. I'm done. Like we'll keep touring for the rest of this year, but I'm not fucking, no way. No more videos, no more singles. Let's get on to our next record and like survive this experience. And they were not happy, but I was like, I don't care. Like I got a whole career to think about, not just this year. And we've already sold a gazillion records. Like we are already coming up on like, I don't know. It was 8 million records worldwide. Ended up selling 10 million records worldwide, I think, that record. You know, but we were already like in the millions, but you know, and we were all, record company included, hoping for maybe 100,000, like, and a good start like REM had, you know what I mean, and good reviews and 100,000, and we'll build a career. Like
you get to your life's rich pageant, you get to your document eventually, you yeah. know.
They spent five albums on an indie label, you know, like, I mean, that was the, but because what you want is a career, not a year. You know, and
that's true, because Ranking could have been, you know, you mentioned Hootie, like Only Want to Be With You is, I think, single 3 for that album. And it became the thing
yeah.
that did the thing that you're talking about.
Yeah, because like Ranking is the catchiest song on the record. And I just like, there's no way. Like, I just said no. And maybe that's short-sighted. I don't know. But
I mean, you ended up creating Recovering the Satellites, which, you know, August is the classic. Recovering is one of the greatest albums of all time.
The problem is what happened was the record label was like, fine, fine. But then what they knew and I had forgotten about was that they had come to me like a year before this, before our first record was even finished probably or out, and said, hey, we're going to put out a DGC Rarities record next year. Can you give me a song for that? I was like, sure. How about this fucking thing?
And that's how that slips in.
That's how I gave them Einstein on the Beach because I loved it. It was a clever, funny, hooky. It was me teaching myself how to write a pop song, you know, and a good one, you know, but nothing I wanted anywhere near August and Everything After, which was a different kind of record to me. And so without reminding me of it or even telling me, fucking DGC Rarity comes out and they put out as the single Einstein on the Beach. I said no to Rain King. I would way rather have had Rain King than Einstein on the Beach. It's way poppier. And yeah, it went straight to number one on alternative radio. Absolutely. And after that, every fucking song on the record went up the radio charts. You know, so Rain King went anyways. And I was so pissed because I was really worried about backlash, which fucking happened. And I really wanted to sort of like tamp it down. And they put out Einstein on the Beach. So, and then there was no stopping the record after that. Every single song, without us putting out anything or making any videos, they almost all, except maybe Ghost Train, went up the fucking, at least the AAA charts for a while. But fucking Einstein went straight to number one. Like,
it's still a fun song. It's still a fun. If there's an alternate universe where you all, right at the end of the Rat Kings, when you finish that, you go straight into that, I think. Because you do good stuff like that. I mean, hearing you do Taylor's The One into Long December and how mind-blowingly well that works. I mean, that kind of stuff has always been there. In fact, while I'm thinking about it too, and we're talking about that early era, because one of the songs also that sort of became a lost song was Marjorie. We'd later on get another Horse Dreamer's Blues, but Marjorie, you know, is on that deluxe edition. You all only played it, I think, a few times. It mentions Lexington, which I'm in Louisville, right up the road from me. Like, how did that end up there? Like, that's one of those songs, right? Because it's a lost song, but it's also still has this separate life in another Horse Dreamer's Blues.
Well, that, I think, has the bones of being a good song. And we did try to record that one for August and Everything After. And we tried to record it again for Recovering Satellites. Like, there are demo versions of that. There's one that's just more acoustic-y that we did with August. There's one that starts, that has all these like Mellotron flutes in it from Satellites. But what I kind of eventually realized is that it didn't really have a chorus at all, and it didn't really work. It's got a lot of great parts to it, great sections. Like, the verse is really good. And it just, it's that one, and there was another one back then called Shallow Days that was a demo that's also on, I think, the August Deluxe version that we also tried to record for August and Everything After. And the same thing, it had these structural problems. It was basically a 2.5 minute pop song that was 5 minutes long, and it wasn't quite making it in either way. Like, it was just dragging the record down, and we couldn't find a way to make the song work, even though we all loved it and it was incredibly hooky. But it's because structurally it just didn't actually work as a song. And that's the same problem to me that Marjorie Dreams of Horses has. It's got these really great parts to it, but then it ends up, it resolves into this where the chorus should be. There's just this kind of like instrumental section that's not the greatest thing in the world. And it just, that's like, sometimes songwriting, you don't completely make it work. And I actually went a few years ago back to that song to try and see if I could figure out how it should be, not Chalidays, but Marjorie, to try and make the chorus it needed or something. And I just couldn't. The fact is that it goes where it goes so confidently and so well, even though where it's going to is that little instrumental strummy section that is kind of a nothing section. It really wants to go there, and I can't get that out of my head. I could not find a way to make a chorus work. And so it just kind of doesn't work as a song, even though sections of it are really, really good. That's different to me than Einstein, which I think does work as a song, but just doesn't mean a lot to me. Yeah, because it just, there was something missing in Marjorie. It just structurally, it didn't work. And the same problem with Shallow Days. It was just like, it seems like a great song, but that great song would be 3 minutes long, and this is five in the case, or five and a half in the case of Shallow Days. And, you know, different structural problem with Marjorie. But
now how do you feel then about, like, because you guys have never released a Lost Dogs or a B-Sides compilation or something like that. And I know one of the things was because the masters, you know, being lost. Although, do I remember this right? Like, they found some of the tapes that you thought were lost?
Yeah, they made more excuses over the years. We can't find them. We've lost them. They burnt in a fire. And then, oh, HBO's making a movie. We'll actually make someone look hard this time. Oh, we found everything. No, they never found the actual tapes. The one thing they didn't find was the actual tapes for Satellites. The original 2-inch, those are gone. They left those at the studio and forgot to pick them up.
But any recordings that, I mean, just go, like, was, that's what I'm asking. Like, the stuff that you did there is all the way gone, or there were just other copies, but not the original source material?
No, what happened is that we, back when you used tape machines, if you had more than 24 tracks, you had to slave one machine to another, which is a pain in the ass, because the one starts, the other starts, and it goes, and then it starts working. So to mix that album, when we finally were doing the mixes for it, we copied everything from two different 20, whatever, however many tracks it was, to a digital tape, so that we could mix it. So we did that as right before we started mixing in the mixing studio. They took the 2 inches and they copied them so you could mix from one machine, as opposed to mixing these two machines that would go every time. You know, it's a huge pain in the ass. And so when it was finished, they took the digital tape that we'd been mixing from and forgot about the 2-inch. The problem is that the digital tape only has the stuff we actually were mixing for the record. So the songs that are on the record, plus Chelsea and Good Luck, I think. So it didn't have, you know, the extra versions of Marjorie, probably. And there was one other song, How Can You Sleep? What the fuck is that song called? I can't remember the name of the song. We wanted to finish it when we were making Saturday Nights, because it's that kind of song. But we could find a version of it that had been, like, mixed on, but not the tapes to use it to make a record from. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, there are, like, mixed down versions of that song and of Marjorie, like, quick rough mixes in the studio, but no, the original tape is gone because they lost the 2 inches. So, but there's not a lot. I don't write a lot of extra songs. So it's not, there was just that song, I can't remember what it's called, that we wanted to do for Saturday Nights. And there's probably Marjorie Dreams of Horses, and that might be about it.
So it's not a lot. I think, you know, that still to be able, and I've said this before, as a fan, to be able to celebrate your favorite albums of all time with anniversary editions and whatever versions they are, and whether that's, you know, that with Live Across the Wire out there. I mean, we still never got the vinyl versions of This Desert Life and the other stuff, you know.
It's like, coming out.
It is coming out.
Yeah, I believe so. I believe we're going to do that this year. We did, a few years ago, we did August again, and we did Satellites. And I think they're also re-releasing a special version of Satellites. And then I think we're going to do This Desert Life and Hard Candy on vinyl. I think it's been talked about.
I hope so.
Makes sense to me. I really love those records. Those might be my two. I don't know if they're my two favorites. I really love those two, though. Desert Life, for the band, I think in a lot of ways, Desert Life is everybody's favorite. It's the one everyone wants to play songs from when we're playing live.
Amy's a top five song for me. Amy Hit the Atmosphere. That's...
Everybody wants to play Amy. We only don't because that requires me to learn the piano parts, and I get lazy about that. But everybody wants to play Wish I Was a Girl and Speedway.
You play Potter a lot, of course.
Potter. Yeah,
that's there. Yeah.
Those songs all get played because that's like the band. There's Desert Life especially was such a quirky, weird record, and it was so creative that everybody loves playing those songs. Like St. Robinson. That song, songs off Desert Life probably get played more than most of the records, except for August, and I guess Hard Candy's pretty popular too. There's a lot of great stuff on that.
Which all the things we said, of course, that leaves behind of that era, Saturday Night, Sunday Mornings, which again, even the two albums are fantastic. The songs that, you know, Le Ballet d'Or, one of the greatest songs that you is just, it's so deep, and I can do that, and with, you know, on and on and on.
I love playing stuff from Saturday nights and Sunday mornings. I think that Washington Square is one of my favorite things we've ever played. We play You Can't Count on Me. When I Dream of Michelangelo. We play Washington Square and When I Dream of Michelangelo a lot. Ballet Door is one of Emmer's favorites. Play Come Around a fair amount. I really love 1492, Hanging Tree. Play Los Angeles sometimes. We would play Sundays more, but it's really hard to sing for me. We need to lower that one because I just don't have the high range to do the outro on Sundays.
Los Angeles, we quote Around the House a lot with that's where Skinny Girls and Tacos. It's street walking. Like the amount of times we'll just say that while we're out, like, and we go some, if you want tacos, if we're eating tacos, it's coming up anyway. That's what I'm getting at.
Great place to find a taco.
Great place to find yourself a taco. I love all the stuff, and I can just keep doing this. And I really appreciate you just letting me get really nerdy with you here on the lower stuff. But seriously, Butter Miracle. I mean, this is the album I was hoping for. This is the album that we dream of getting. The fact that you made it there. Yeah.
I'm really, and it was kind of great to make it in two shots. I wish the only thing that really bothers me is that I spent 2 years doing nothing with it while I was sitting around, because then it would have come closer. I really liked making the half record at a time, making EPs. It really bothered me because there's a problem with getting people to review EPs. Like, people don't like to, they want to do whole albums. Whereas I was like, why can't I just write a 4-song suite? It's like, when I wrote it, I had no plans for a larger record. It was just the challenge of writing a 20-minute piece of music, and I really was excited about that. And very, like, I still have a great feeling of satisfaction and pride over, like, something that was really hard to do and doing it. The suite is so cool to me. And also it was kind of nice not to like sit in the studio for months and months and try and do this big thing, but just to do a smaller thing. I just wish I hadn't sat for 2 years with those songs, because that made everything, like, it made it really a long time. It'll end up being 4 years, I guess.
But we made it there. And that suite was fun because I think, you'd done the Round Here, you'd done the Palisades, those long songs like that. And to finally take it into this.
Yeah, I was really building to that in ways I didn't really see at the time. Like, for years after Round Here, we had been doing these things live where we really expanded on our songs. But I had never really composed one that internalized that until Palisades Park, which is another song I fucking love. I'm so proud of that. That piece of music was so, it's such a leap, and such a, like, shoot for the moon. And so, like, but I think that also really led me to making the suite too. The idea of, like, continuous pieces of music that flow together that are all, but in this case, they're also short songs, like, they're not, it's not like an unwieldy song like Mrs. Potter's Lullaby. It's actually, they're not that long. And then I don't know, it felt right to also have, like, a complete, like, almost glam punk record for the other half that just, like, these are 3-minute songs. They're like, they're also not bloated, except for Aurora is this great long.
And the back and forth voices and everything.
Yeah. It's like, it's almost like a day in the life. We're like, okay, we'll take this one out for a while. We'll put all the bells and whistles. We'll throw strings. We'll throw harmonies. It'll be a big, fun, like, Sgt. Pepper's end to this first half of the record. And it's a little long. It's funny though. They got the same reaction from the record company that Mrs. Potter's Lullaby got, which is, oh my God, this is a hit single. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's an 8-minute song. Yeah. But it's so catchy. It's a hit. How can it be a hit? Well, we'll edit it. I'm like, if you edit 3 minutes out of the song, it's still a 5-minute song. Like, it's still too fucking long.
But people also expect, like, not expect that from you all, but you've done it. I mean, again, the fact that Round Here was able to exist like it did on the radio, that didn't happen. Like, you can get away with it is what I'm saying.
Well, it worked for Round Here. It didn't work for Mrs. Potter's. Like, that did not end up on the radio. It's great live and fans love it, but it's an album track. I got the same response from this album. There's a lot of hooky tracks on this record. And immediately they were so excited about Aurora. And I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake. But it's still six. This is a 6-minute song, I think. I don't know how long it is. It's got to be around 6 minutes. Like, it will not work on the radio.
Well, as someone who programs a radio station,
you play it. I would love that. I would love if everybody played it.
I do know. Of course, we're going to give Spaceman its due, and I cannot wait to get to Boxcar, and I'm even going to play the hell out of With Love from A to Z. Bet your ass I will eventually make it to Aurora, though. It's going to happen. So, because I even have that title track to August that you guys finally put out a few years ago, and that's what 10 minutes in itself. Like, I keep that in rotation, you know. It doesn't get a lot of play, but it gets in there. So
No, I mean, I think that is great. And I've worked really hard on writing the songs that I wrote that are longer, like Mrs. Potter's Lullaby or Palisades Park, they're perfect to me. Like, they work at that length. But that doesn't matter if your programmers can't put things that are over 330, you know, on the radio. Like, I don't know. I think they work and they'd be great. I mean, we could talk all we want about how great Like a Rolling Stone is. Like a Rolling Stone is on the radio and that everyone loves it. But that doesn't mean they're going to do that for us. I wish they would.
And not every station gets away with what we get away with. I mean, we are a AAA station, you know, a public radio station. But, you know, I just put in an 8-minute version of a live, 8-minute live version of Don't You Forget About Me, because we can. You know, it's like, it's hard to be a radio station in 2025 anyway. We might as well have fun with it, you know.
Have you seen Becoming Led Zeppelin yet?
No, I haven't. It's there, it's waiting for me.
It's gonna blow your mind.
I've
It
heard.
is. It is so good. That is what a music documentary should be. That movie, there are four or five, I can't remember if it's four or five, full songs performance-wise during this period. It's only about the first two records, really. But that movie includes four or five full songs that they perform. And they're so good. One of them is Dazed and Confused, which is like 10 minutes long. But it is such a luxury as a music fan that someone cared enough to make that movie and was willing to do it and willing to believe that you have the attention span to sit through a song. Because it is very hard to convince people of that. And I shouldn't talk about it, but you will see that it's not true of everyone. Not everyone believes that. And it's a shame. But that movie for a music fan, my girlfriend, not that she doesn't like Led Zeppelin, she's okay with Zeppelin, but she's not really like a geek like I am or Immer is, you know. And we went to see that movie, and right after that, I can't remember what the first song they played was. It might have been Heartbreaker, I can't remember. But like, she was just like, "This is the fucking greatest movie." I mean, she loves music, but I don't
This is
think
the way I've
Zeppelin.
heard people talk about it. Like, I've got to this weekend make the time.
It is
I think it's going to
fucking brilliant.
happen.
And if you could see it, like, you know, I think they put it out in IMAX. If you could
Yeah.
see it on a big screen with big sound, because it's big, it's loud, it's fucking amazing. It's totally for music fans, for anyone who professes to like music. That's the thing, man.
Recommendation noted. Thank you very much. Thanks for continuing to do what you do. And I really do mean that. I seriously do mean that. Congrats on Butter Miracle finally making its way out. It's a perfect album.
I really, really love it from A to Z, from the
Yeah.
beginning.
I can't wait to hear it live. I'll be seeing you guys. I know at Non-Com in Philly, but I want to see a full show. So I'm gonna you don't have any I don't
It'll
think.
be up very soon. We're going out starting the beginning of June. So
Right on. All right, Adam, thank you so much. It was good talking to you again.
thanks, man. Have a good one.
My thanks to Adam Duritz, Counting Crows, Butter Miracle is out now. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Hit that subscribe button before you get out of here so you can get all the interviews that we send your way every single week. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, anywhere you get your podcast from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith with. Please do give this series a rating and leave a review while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday starting 6 p.m. Eastern. It's 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music, bonus interviews, music news. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from The Who, Lobo, Dusty Springfield, Olivia Dean, Crash Test Dummies, The Suicide Machines, Toad the Wet Sprocket, INXS, The Bad Plus, David Gray, James Bay, Plum, Ed Monk, Arcade Fire, The Beach Boys, The Sundays, Van Morrison, and my interview with Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth. That's what you get weeknights starting 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence has your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. I do hope you like and follow along. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Okay, if it starts to echo, just tell me.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.